You're listening to The Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 11th of June 2021 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily is brought to you in association with Allianz.
How to bring a divided America together. The perils of picking the proper present for a president or prime minister. And a welcome back to Record Store Day. I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily in association with Allianz starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Marcus Hippie will be discussing all of the aforementioned and sorting out once and for all which of the teams contesting the Copa America and the European Football Championship will be best dressed. Stay tuned, that's all coming up right here on the Monocle Daily in association with Allianz on Monocle 24. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests today are Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Monocle's senior correspondent, and Marcus Hippie, Monocle's senior producer and presenter. Welcome both. This is the end of week one of the new Revivified Daily with actual guests live in the studio. And we are bringing back the tradition of the old Friday Midori House, in which the panelists were whichever members of staff hadn't yet thought of an excuse to be out of the building by 1800 on Friday.
And here we are again.
And he you both are.
It's a very civilized time, I think.
It is a very civilized time. Are you both as excited to be here as I am to have you both here? And you can read that whichever way you like.
I am actually quite excited about this. It's been a long wait, obviously, for having us all back in the office, sitting in the same room without having to be worried. And it's also great to be back on the Monocle Daily. It's been a long wait.
It has been a long wait. Well, we will have more from you both later in the show. But first, if there is one thing on which Americans are united, it is the proposition that America is divided by race, by faith, by media consumption, by party affiliation. In 2017, the German newspaper Die Zeit, noticing something similar in the country it covered, launched Germany Talks, a project which would match volunteer readers with a political opposite and encourage them to hear each other out and ideally recall that they might have more in common than not. That idea is about to be launched now in the United States, the roiling and rancorous United States, indeed. And I am joined now by Kristen Hansen, Executive Director of the Civic Health Project, who is the lead organizer of it. So, first of all, Kristen, the idea did come from Germany, as we were just saying. What is going to be important, do you think, about America Talks?
Well, hello, Andrew, and thanks. I wish I were right there in the room with you as well, but greetings from California, where we're putting the finishing touches on America Talks. This is an important event for our country, an opportunity to bridge Americans across divides. We've signed up more than 6,000 Americans already to join this conversation event. It'll be the single biggest political conversation event of its kind yet here in the U.S., and I would venture to say it's coming at an important time in our country.
Well, on the subject of that important time, it has become axiomatic that the United States has never been more divided, although you could point to the events of 1861 to 1865 as evidence that it has been worse. But do you think it is actually important that this be done now, following the Capitol Hill riot, following the Black Lives Matter protests, following 4 years of Donald Trump? Is now actually the moment because of those reasons?
Yeah, Andrew, thanks for asking. I completely agree. It's a very raw time here in America. And at the same time, those of us who work in the political bridge building field perceive an opening right now, because it is also true that so many Americans are also expressing a lot of fatigue with the level of acrimony and division. We can sense that this just isn't working for us right now. We need something different, and there's actually tremendous appetite for it.
So, what are you setting when you match these people up and send them away to go and talk to each other about what they disagree about? Do you provide them with guidance, with ground rules?
Yeah, absolutely. And I really want to emphasize that the conversations that we're holding over the weekend aren't really framed as a debate so much as an opportunity to connect. It is true that we are connecting people based on difference, just like in the European program, where you specifically match people based on the different ways that they answer a set of survey questions. But once we bring them together, we kick them off with a set of conversation norms, which are listen with curiosity, speak from your own experience, and connect with respect. And just to put a few more guardrails around that experience, we're actually going to be bringing people into a purpose-built hosted platform, giving them a conversation guide, and really helping them step by step through a process that we think will be really constructive and even surprising in helping them find ways that they may have more in common than they realized.
I can't figure out in my own head whether this is likely to be easier in the United States or more difficult in the United States than it might be in other countries, because the thing that has struck me when I've traveled in the United States, and I've been all over it as a journalist, is that actually Americans in general are remarkably good and remarkably open about discussing the things they think, that they do generally respond with curiosity if you put an opposite view. And yet on the other side of that, a lot of those opinions, those viewpoints, it strikes me, are embedded as totems of people's identities in a way that they're not in many other places.
Yeah, that's right, Andrew. And of course, social media does a lot to help us reinforce and project those totems, those identities out into the world. What we find about face-to-face, real-time conversation is something completely different. This is true in Europe. This is true for the program that we're running here, which is that people really bring their best selves into real-time face-to-face conversation. And so that's why we are really invested in this program and this experience as a way for thousands of Americans to directly experience that connection with someone who is politically different from them, but also to model that and showcase that this is possible. Our aim is to reach millions more Americans with this message that bridging divides can happen. And we recognize that, you know, one conversation, even if multiplied by thousands of Americans, is not going to heal our country. But it's a start, and we've got to start somewhere.
Is the hope, then, that the people who participate in these conversations will take what they've learned or what they've experienced away and have conversations with other people? Because, as I'm sure you've already noticed, the possible inbuilt flaw to this plan is that the kind of people likeliest to volunteer for it are the kind of people who probably aren't really the problem, if they're at least willing to have the conversation.
Yeah, that's right. We call that the propensity to bridge, and it's higher in some people and lower than others. But there are hundreds of organizations here in the U.S. We're all part of something called the Listen First Coalition, really dedicated to this project of demonstrating to Americans that bridging and connecting is possible across our divides and that it's imperative for us to do it. So right on the heels of America Talks, we're shepherding all of our participants and everyone who's learned about this event into an entire National Week of Conversation. We've got more than 100 organizations hosting events throughout this coming week to provide further opportunities to connect, listen, and share experience.
Kristen Hansen, thank you for joining us. Marcus and Fernando, do you have any issues that divide you that you would like to discuss as a matter of any great urgency?
We do, actually, the etiquette of wearing shorts at the office.
Or even some food and food topics, yeah, I think we disagree.
I noticed you moved off the shorts thing very quickly there, Fernando, for the certainology you were about to be outvoted 2-1. But anyway, you are listening to The Daily. Still with me, as you have just heard, are Marcus Hippie and Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And all this week on The Daily, we have been contemplating the G7 summit, which is now underway in Cornwall and has not degenerated into an all-in chair throwing fisticuffs as we go to air. One of the subtexts of any such wingding is the exchange of gifts among the leaders. US President Joe Biden, making his first overseas trip as leader of the Free Etc., seems to have made a genuine effort re his present to the host, UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson. A very swish bicycle and helmet decorated in red, white and blue livery, extolling the special relationship. In return, Johnson gave Biden a framed photo of a mural of Frederick Douglass, though the photo does seem, and I am not making this up, to have been downloaded from Douglass's Wikipedia page. The UK is apparently that broke. I did want to ask you both each in turn, first you, Marcus, what you would give a foreign leader visiting Finland other than, of course, a gruff handshake.
I know. It really depends on the leader in question, but I guess I have to go for the basics. I have to go to the cliches. So I would give probably Finnish design, or maybe something, you know, Finland is doing a lot of tech stuff now, so maybe a gadget, maybe a computer game, because we're doing them now as well.
What about that salted licorice ice cream topping? Because that genuinely is amazing.
I know, but it's a very divisive. For example, Fernando, I actually have to tell this story to you once, because I brought those candies over here here to London, I gave one to Fernando, and Fernando is always very polite, smiles and claims to enjoy those things. But I left the room for a second, and when I came back, Fernando was by the bin trying to get that thing out from his mouth. So that's
true
an
story.
Example of you have to be really mindful about these things.
Well, it does demonstrate that, you know, these things are a minefield. Fernando, in the frankly unlikely event that you ever did find yourself as president of Brazil, though you're still a relatively young man, what would you distribute among foreign leaders visiting?
I think especially if I want a good business deal to myself and to my country, I would definitely give a chair designed by Brazilian designer Sergio Rodrigues. Is made of jacaranda wood. I generally think it's a very chic piece. I mean, it's very expensive actually these days if you want to buy a vintage one. So I think they'll be very lucky if they'll get one from me.
Has anybody here ever been given anything by a foreign leader?
I was telling Marcus that I've been promised something that didn't really arrive the address. When I interviewed former President Dilma Rousseff, she said she was mentioning quite a few books during the interview. I don't remember the names of the books, but she said, "Don't you worry, just give your address and my assistant will send them to you." I'm still waiting, Dilma.
I haven't got anything from any foreign leaders, but I have to say that if Vladimir Putin of Russia is good at something, he's very good in giving presents. Finland's president, Sauli Niinistö, a couple of years ago got a delivery from him, and they had old documents of former Finnish president Mannerheim, who was also a war hero, some documents found from the Russian archives that Finland did not know of, and the Finnish president got those for his 70th birthday present.
That is a cool present. I have an autographed copy of a book of the desk doodles of Albanian Prime Minister Edi Rama.
Do you want to tell us a story about how you got that?
I was interviewing him for Monocle magazine, and he gave it to me as I left his office. He is an artist by trade before he went into politics, and he's on the blotting paper on his desk, he draws in the margins these lovely sort of whirling, colourful doodles, and some incredibly posh, flash German publisher had packaged them all up into a very nice book, which he signed a copy of and gave me.
I mean, that's very thoughtful, I find.
I was given a tote bag full of stuff by San Marino's prime minister, who is also the postman. He's not really.
So you asked this question to basically get to tell people what you've been getting.
I did basically do that. I mean, it is just a tote bag and a book. It's not anything terrifically exciting. Anyway, I'm getting wind-up gestures from inside the production booth, and probably quite reasonably, telling us that we should move along to the veritable feast of football commencing this weekend, indeed later tonight when Italy hosts Turkey in Rome. The European Football Championships and the Copa America will be happening at the same time, which means that two continents will be hosting tournaments of national teams, hoping not merely to excel on the field, but to create a good impression off it. That being the case, we are now going to direct our attention to whom in either competition has the best kit. Now, obviously, I'm out of this in terms of looking at my own country because, unlike, for example, the Eurovision Song Contest, Australia has not figured out how to get ourselves invited to either the Copa America or the European Football Championships. You're all just scared. Fernando, let's start with you, and let's start with Brazil, who's, I mean, everybody knows Brazil's kit. Brazil are always extremely smartly turned out. But as we have discussed a few times just in the office, the kit has changed meaning for some Brazilians. And I should furnish a bit of backdrop here by telling our listeners that one of the absolute joys of working in this building during a World Cup is that Fernando, and I am not making this up, does turn up for work wearing not merely the Brazil shirt, but the shorts and the socks, the full kit.
But the sad thing, Andrew, that I'm not sure if I'll be able to do that in the next World Cup, because you're very right. It's so quickly that this became, before it was a source of pride. But now if I wear that, I might be confused with a Bolsonaro supporter. One day in the airport in São Paulo, I was wearing yellow, not even the national kit. And a woman looked at me smiling, said, "Bolsonaro." And then I didn't know what to do. I was like, "Oh my God, I'm actually not a supporter." So it's really difficult. For me, I would like to reclaim back because I do love the kit. And as you say, it is iconic. So let's wait and see. But I think for this Copa America, at least, I might be keeping things a little bit discreet, even though I do love the design of our kit.
Okay, we will come back shortly to the competitors for best dressed at the Copa America. But in terms of the European Championship, Marcus, we need to talk about Finland's. And I'm aware that there might be controversy here. I quite like Finland's kit, which is just as well because I am still incredibly angry about the fact that I am one of the members of staff here at Monocle who has been assigned Finland in the sweepstake. So I'm not going to win, and so has Carlotta, the producer, who is sighing so audibly that we can hear her through the soundproof glass. But I do like Finland's kit, but you, I understand, do not.
I was just thinking that I would not wear this. I printed this picture that is black and white, which kind of doesn't show you the real colours. But basically, the Finnish kit consists of, well, it's a white shirt with a blue cross across
Finland's,
your chest.
It's Finland's flag,
it's Finland's
basically.
Flag, yeah. And I think it's just, you know, I guess these times when we have these right-wing movements that try to own flags and national symbols, I'm a bit wary about that as well. It's not because I don't want to be identified with, say, the major political parties or the leader of Finland, but it's still like this idea of, like, you know, being... Also, I guess living in London, being pigeonholed as a Finnish, and I'm like, nowadays, you know, having two passports and stuff, I'm wondering, am I that Finnish? I think it's a bit, I don't know, it's just not me. And also, you know, when we talk about football, I have to point out that it's the first time for Finland, by the way, when we are in these championships, and I have to admit, I'm just a little bit out of my comfort zone, because I haven't really talked about football that much, because just ask me anything about ice hockey and I'm fine with it, or skiing or ski jumping, but this football, what is that?
Or middle distance running or motor racing.
Exactly.
Well, then let's talk about who is the best dressed at either of these tournaments. And let's look first at the Copa America. Fernando, I really like Ecuador's kit. They look like a team of mad bumblebees in their yellow and black horizontal stripes. I think a shirt should be striking and simple and yet kind of splashy. I really like it. I think it's cool.
It's very splashy, I have to say. I mean, one thing that I agree, Andrew, I think we discussed this before, I think the sash at the Peruvian national team...
The Peruvian one is classy.
Perhaps a little bit more elegant than the Ecuadorian bumblebees, in my opinion. But, you know, I do like Peru. And I have to say, I mean, I might contradict myself, because even though I'm embarrassed to wear the Brazilian kit, I think it's a classic that didn't change, unlike the Argentinian one. They decided to play around with kind of, you know, with kind of the geometric forms in their shirt, which I didn't like it very much, I have to say. Not because it's Argentina, by the way.
Marcus, do you have a favourite on either the Copa America or the European
Championships? Well, I was looking at these, and I think it's the Argentinian kit that I quite like. I like these fresh colours you get from the Argentinian flag, and kind of like, it just looks good. It's not too much. It's the right amount of attention seeking.
We just need to name very quickly our favourites at the European Championships as well. If we don't like Finland, who do we like?
It's clear to me that it's Germany. Super elegant. I love their shirt with where the emblem is in black. I think it's very sleek, and that's my vote.
I'm going to say France.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I think the Swedes are always very well dressed at these things, at the risk of causing a certain amount of Scandinavian rage over there.
The reason why I say France is that Finnish people are always so obsessed about what other countries think about us, and supposedly, according to the Finnish media, there's been a lot of people online from France saying that they like the Finnish kit.
There you go. So it's basically me and France agrees on the Finland kit. Marcus Hippie and Fernando Augusto Pacheco, thank you both for the moment. We will have more from you both shortly. This is The Daily on Monocle 24.
Allianz is proud to partner The Monocle Daily on Monocle 24. Everyone at Allianz is passionate about securing people's lives and giving them courage for what's ahead, no matter what. Another core principle at Allianz is a belief in equality of opportunity and a belief that diverse minds and abilities make a company more innovative, more resilient, and better equipped for the future. Allianz. Confidence in tomorrow.
And welcome back to the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller. Still with me are my guests, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Marcus Hippie. But first, the Serpentine Pavilion opens to the public today in London's Hyde Park. This temporary structure, designed by a different architect each year, is now in its 20th iteration. Monocle's Alexis Self went down to Hyde Park to check it out for the Monocle Daily.
Every year since 2000, well, except for last year, an architect has been commissioned to build a temporary structure on the lawn next to the Serpentine Gallery in London's Hyde Park. Now in its 20th iteration, Serpentine Pavilions have been designed by some of the world's most lauded bricks and mortar artists, such as Zaha Hadid and Oscar Niemeyer. Despite its rather prim surroundings and long list of corporate sponsors, the pavilion is a radical notion, an interactive piece of high art located within the grounds of an internationally renowned commercial gallery that is open free of charge to the public, who are invited to work, sleep beneath, and climb upon it. In recent years, the job of designing it has usually been given to a young architect. This year's, carried over from 2020, has been given to a few. It's the first time it's been designed by a collective, in this case, Johannesburg-based Practice Counterspace. On a wonderful summer's day, I strolled the half an hour from Monocle HQ to the Serpentine to check it out and meet the pavilion's lead architect, Sumaya Valley. I began by asking her the inspiration behind the design.
So when I first started to work on the commission, I was really inspired by London and I wanted to reflect London to London. I'm from Johannesburg, so because of that and because of my way of practice, I'm really interested in thinking about what's beneath the surface and in thinking about places that are often overlooked and how we can generate conversation and discourse and work around them. So in London, I started to look at spaces with significance to migration, which is all of London really. But then within that, I started to look at small spaces in London that had particular significance for migrations and for communities to come together. So I started out the research when I arrived in London at the Bishopsgate Library and Archive. I looked at their pamphlet collection extensively, which started to direct me to some of the spaces I was interested in. So, for example, the Theatre for Black Women, the Four Aces Club in Dalston, which was one of the first venues in London to play black music, the Centre Price Publishing House, which was a really important centre for black literature, some of the first mosques and houses of worship that people created for themselves when they arrived in London.
Your pavilion is an homage to London, the way it looks, and also its communities. Do you still think in 2021 that London is a beautiful city? And do you still think it's one that is a kind of haven for people from all over the world?
Absolutely. I love London and I am so deeply inspired by all of its stories, by its histories and its continuities of resistance, of revolution, of belonging, of diversity. I'm inspired that it is so deeply textured, it's so rich in holding so many cultures, and also that it really is a center for hybridity. I think all of us in some way are insiders and outsiders.
After my attempt at an architectural critique, I spoke to Hans-Ulrich Obrast, the Serpentine superstar curator. I asked him what significance the pavilion still holds in the public imagination.
For us, the pavilion is our annual kind of, you know, project with architecture, but it's also the idea of doing a gathering space, space for people to meet in the park. It has free admissions and it has no doors, you know, because very often exhibitions have doors, but the pavilion is open, has no doors, and that means people can just, you know, also discover it without maybe in the morning thinking they're going to go to an art show or an architecture show. Immediately very, very convinced by what Sumaya proposed with her colleagues, because we felt it was very interesting that she addressed the pavilion, you know, not as a continental kind of shape, but more as an archipelago. And as Edouard Glissant pointed out, the great, you know, thinker of the archipelagos, he always said, you know, an archipelago is welcoming, is sheltering, is not homogenizing. And we thought it was very interesting that for the first time, you know, the pavilion would happen not only here, but would happen in many different neighborhoods in London. And we also loved the idea that Sumaya wanted to listen to the city, so that it's actually about listening. It's going to be a listening session here. There are going to be sound pieces, initially by Brian Eno, Sound Experiments, later on by Jay Bernard and many others. So visitors can actually come here to listen as well. But that's exactly what Sumaya did, you see, because Sumaya spent 4 months in a row, and then I would say at least another month, and she's going to stay here now until July. So all in all, you know, more than half a year in London, listening to London, listening to the communities.
After speaking to Hans, I switched off my recorder and wandered back under the concrete canopy. Clambering up the pavilion's ramparts, microphone in hand, I realized I've been visiting these structures since I was 11 years old. I'm not saying I've measured out my life in serpentine pavilions. That would be unbearably pretentious. but all 20 lined up might form a weird, abstract bus route, snaking its way through my childhood, teenage years, and early adulthood. So, how does the 2021 edition compare with the rest? Well, it's certainly bigger, I think. And its rose-hued concrete blocks demonstrate an interesting evocation of London's urban pastures. On a hot day, it provided peaceful refuge from the sun, giving one the sensation of being inside a large, cool building. Its many levels, its blocks arrayed in ascending order, and its gentle slopes will be great fun for children to explore, which is perhaps the most ringing endorsement I can give. A grown adult for Monocle 24 in London's Hyde Park. I'm Alexis Self.
Thank you, Alexis. Finally, on today's programme, one of the many things which did not occur last year, at least not as it should have, was Record Store Day, which since 2007 has encouraged the patronage of such record stores as may still be found. It is back this year, however, spread across two dates, one of which is tomorrow. So I guess what we should do at this point is talk about record stores and how excited we are that we can go back into them. Are you going to be going to a record store tomorrow, Fernando?
Well, probably, because I live in a place where there are many kind of record stores here in London, which is Soho. And it's always so lively, actually. And I even have a funny story. My former neighbor, she's an elderly woman, Daphne, and her Yorkshire Terrier called Sasha. She became viral on a World Record Day because there was some DJs playing out in the streets and they were playing Daft Punk around the world. And her video basically became viral. People are still sharing that. So that's kind of the joys of record stores, because they're trying to attract customers to their shops. So, you know, they have DJs, you know, they have special records. So I'll definitely be browsing around tomorrow. And I love record shops, and I wish they would never disappear, even though, you know, there is always the danger here.
Were they an important part, Marcus, of growing up in Finland? Did you strap on the snowshoes and tie a moose to the sled and journey into, however it is you people travel?
It was quite tricky to finally get to those record stores I really enjoyed. One of the reasons I had to leave Finland back in the day when I was younger was that the Finnish music scene was so awful, just heavy rock and metal. And I went to my local record store and they would only have like Metallica, Guns N' Roses and some hideous Finnish rock. And in order to find anything better...
Was that a special section? Did they have a designated hideous Finnish rock rack?
It was just what it was there. So I went to my local grocery store in this small village and they would have some CDs or vinyls over there. Then I would go to this record store that was specialised in heavy metal. I had to leave. I had to come to London and Manchester quite often, come to England and actually go and see these amazing, magical places. I still recall. It's sad that we don't really have that many of them left over here nowadays, for obvious reasons.
Fernando, you, I believe, attempted to become an actual record store guy.
I did, but apparently they didn't want me. You know, as soon as I moved to London, I've applied to work at HMV. I sent quite a lot of CVs. I wonder if I was almost harassing them. But they didn't call me back. It's a shame because I was such a good customer of them, you know.
Was this an actual childhood dream of yours?
It was. I mean, who knows? Maybe I could still open my record store, you know. Here it is. I think that could be a good idea, because I think people still love the physical product. I mean, just look at the success of vinyls. I mean, it's definitely not over, and I believe in that. So maybe...
I was just going through on the phone my record collection from all those trips to England, what I used to buy from here. And I think it's interesting that I didn't really realize this before, but I think buying singles was quite a British thing, because we didn't do that in Finland. And like, you know, I've got loads and loads of CD singles I've bought from here in Finland still waiting to be taken somewhere. I'm going to keep them. I'm not going to give them to anyone else or sell them, but I'll keep them there, and maybe one day I'll buy a CD player again.
That's very special, the singles. It's a very British thing. In Brazil, we didn't have singles, and they become quite rare. I used to go every Monday to record shops here to buy the latest singles.
Singles were an Australian thing as well, at which point I will confess that I was a record store guy. Music Plus Records of Willoughby Road in Crow's Nest in Sydney. If anybody has any questions about what it was actually like to work in a record shop, it is a really good way to develop an extremely low opinion of the general public. I will pass that along.
Can you imagine if I was your customer, Andrew? I'm sure you would do some crazy faces to me.
I would have been leaning very heavily on the little button we had just under the cash register, which had customer eject switch written on it. Regrettably, not actually linked to any apparatus capable of launching Tracy Chapman fans through the skylight, but you work with what you've got. That is all for this edition of the Monocle Daily. A big thanks to my panellists today, Marcos Hippi and Fernando Augusto Pacheco, also to Kristen Hansen of America Talks and to Monocle's Alexa Self. Today's show was produced by Carlotta Ribello and researched by Sophie Monaghan-Coombs. Our studio engineer was Steph Chungu. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily returns at the same time on Monday, 1800 London. Have a great weekend and thanks for listening.